Hello and welcome to another edition of Beautiful Minds, an exploration into the minds of creative people and what makes them tick. This show is brought to you by Audio Journal and sponsored by the Memorial Foundation for the Blind. Opinions expressed on this program do not reflect the views and or opinions of Audio Journal, its board of directors, staff, or volunteer readers. The goal of our program is to offer insight into the beautiful and creative minds of all types of artistic people right here in the New England area. My guest today is John Daige, otherwise known as J.D. J.D. is a decorated Army veteran, retired Worcester police officer, cancer survivor, mountain climber, cyclist, and an author. This is part one of a two-part interview with J.D. Let's jump right in.
Okay. Yeah, when we were on the news, I looked because I checked the Amazon KDP of like book sales, and of course they've like gone to like a, you know, I was doing two a day for a couple months, then it was down, and then after the news thing on WCVB, I had like 16 sales this month. I was like, because I had like zero. I'm like, all right, that works.
That's good.
Yeah,
yeah, I know the feeling. I when I put out my records, initially there was this big spike on my ASCAP account, and then it just drops right off a cliff.
Yeah. I think I'm over 350.
Good.
Which is like pretty, I had no idea what I was going to fucking sell.
Yeah.
And you don't do it for sales. You do it for the book, and then, you know, it's not like you fucking make money off of it when Amazon takes a ton.
Yeah. Yeah, but, of course. All right. Well, you know what? Let's, I'm keeping all this, so.
Yeah. It's usually how it goes.
Yeah, but I'm talking with John Daige, otherwise known as J.D.
Yep.
Right? We've been friends a long time, haven't we?
Yeah. I think you've known me for a very long time.
I think I have. I remember meeting you. You were a wee lad.
Yeah.
Not that wee, but certainly I remember, I think the first time I think I remember meeting you was at the Irish Times.
Oh, yeah.
And I think you had just come home from being in the service.
Yeah, that sounds right.
And Robin Steiger, my bandmate and friend, and your uncle.
Yeah.
Your true drunken uncle.
Yeah.
he introduced us and told me that you had just done a tour over in Iraq.
Yes.
Yeah. I've sort of set it up, but why don't you go ahead and just kind of tell me a little bit about yourself, even though I know everything about
you. Sure, yeah. Grew up in Leicester, Massachusetts. Have an older sister who's about 10 months older. I was kept my parents on their toes. I was born 2 months premature.
Mm.
So then I had my last rites read to me when I couldn't breathe and was in an incubator for several weeks.
My goodness.
Then I think the priest didn't want to. I mean, I don't remember this, but from, you know, my parents, they didn't want to baptize me because I already had my last rites read to me.
Wow.
Which was kind of interesting. I guess it works as a sort of baptism, as your last rites.
Okay. Yeah, I guess that makes sense.
Grew up in a small town. I mean, Leicester is not much there. Grew up doing team sports, baseball, football. Then when I was old enough, I wanted to save up for a car. So I started working in my dad's metal steel shop. So if it wasn't football season, I was working a little bit to save money. So I think working at a young age helped me realize the value of a dollar.
Yeah.
Because if you wanted something, you had to buy it with your money.
With your money.
Yeah, exactly. So, and that's something I'm trying to show my kids who are 11 and 14 to be like, this is how you appreciate things is when you pay for it, not when mom and dad pays for it.
Yeah. So how old are you now?
I just turned 43. Yeah. So working for my dad, 2001 hit. I graduated high school, had zero plans for college.
Mm-hmm.
I knew it would be something that I might want to do in the future. I never tested well. And
What you wanted to do what in the future? Go to college.
Maybe go to college.
Yeah, sure. Yeah, okay.
And then 9/11 happened. So planes hit the towers. And then 2 days later, I went to the recruiter. And then I said, you know, I want to serve the bigger purpose. And I always thought about being a cop as well.
Mm-hmm.
And in Mass at the time, there was, I mean, 2001, I think there was like 30,000 people that took the state police test. Mm-hmm. So like if you were not top of the list or a veteran, you weren't getting picked.
Yeah.
And there was no way I was at the top of the list for grading.
Yeah.
So I'm like, well, I need the veteran status. And, I didn't join for the veteran status. Mm-hmm. I joined, because I wanted to join the Army. So I joined the Army Reserve, which is the contract was 6x2. So you drill 6 years of 1 weekend a month, 2 weeks a year of doing Army stuff.
Mm-hmm.
And then during the regular week, you're doing your 9-to-5 work stuff.
Yeah.
Then if you want to go active duty, it's either, a 2-year contract, 3-year, 4-year contract. But once you sign those papers and you get orders and go to basic training, like you're on active duty 24/7.
Yeah.
And if it sucks, there's nowhere to go.
Right.
So my thought,
you can go AWOL.
Yeah, you could. My thought process was, well, let me join. If I like it, then I could go active duty. But you can't go active duty and say, month one, hey, this sucks, I want to go reserve. They're like, no way.
Yeah.
So I wanted to drive cool Army trucks and ended up going to basic training at Fort Knox about a month after 9/11. And because I was a support MOS, so military occupational specialty, your job, was a truck driver.
Mm-hmm.
But they were pushing through infantry-style units first because of the global war on terror.
Sure, yeah.
So we had to wait around for, I think it was 2 weeks before we actually started basic training, which was the worst. Like, everyone thinks you sign the papers, you get on the bus, you get off the bus, you're getting yelled at, you get your uniforms on, you shave your head, and you're starting.
Yeah.
It wasn't like that for us. It was, you get off the bus, you do paperwork, then you get barracks, and then you get your gear, then you shave your, another day goes by. It's go wait in formation outside, wait around, then get some gear. So it was called reception,
mm-hmm.
and it was 2 weeks long, and it just sucked because day zero didn't even start yet.
Yeah. That sounds really pleasant, though, reception.
Yeah. Yeah.
They give you something to drink and a snack.
Yeah, you hop in old barracks. I remember they actually had Krispy Kreme donuts.
Oh, I was joking, but okay.
But nobody wanted to touch them. They're like, oh, they put pills, 18-year-old kids in the Army. They're like, they put pills in them. They don't want to see you eating them. And I'm like, if I knew then what I know now, I would have eaten all of them because it didn't matter. But, yeah, then started basic training, and I loved it. I'm like, wait, they're paying me to march around and shoot guns and do Army stuff? I'm like, this is awesome.
Yeah.
So went through basic training, went to truck driving school, and then came home and worked for my dad again in the steel fab company for the summer up until January of 03. Then we get a phone call. Hey, come to the unit. I was attached to... Well, I was in 325th Transportation Unit out of Brockton, Mass.
Yeah.
So if you're in the reserves, they put you somewhere local. So I had to drive an hour to Brockton every month. And then they were like, hey, bring all your gear. We're getting deployed. And for reservists, you have to do paperwork. You have to do medical, dental, all this stuff.
Mm-hmm.
So we had a two-month pre-deployment status. Then March 24th, we ended up going to Kuwait.
Mm-hmm.
So we call that in theater. And then our company commander asked for some volunteers to go to Iraq. And of course, I raised my hand. I'm like, I'm not just going to sit here in Kuwait and drink Tang and eat beef jerky and play softball. So me and a couple guys raised our hands and we hopped in the back of a 5-ton, which is a military cargo truck.
Mm-hmm.
Usually in the movies, you see they have like a tent over it, but there was no tent. So it was about 120 degrees in the back of a truck in Kuwait. And we had our chemical suits on, which was, so basically you have your Army camis, then you have this like winter suit, because the suit is a chemical suit and it has charcoal in it as like a part of a decontamination for chemical warfare.
Mm-hmm.
And then you have your mask on your hip. And the first day we got there, we're getting off the plane and we heard lightning, lightning, lightning. And everyone's looking at each other like, what is that?
Mm-hmm.
Because we trained gas, 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 which means put your mask on as fast as you can.
Yeah.
So we saw people on base that were already there putting their masks on. So then we're like, oh, shit, like put our masks on, ran to a bunker. Then we put our chemical suits on.
Yeah.
And then for that whole week we're in Kuwait, it just kept scud attacks, alarms were going off.
The Scud missile.
Scud missile, yeah. There actually was two Scuds that hit, I think, the day or the day after we got there.
Mm-hmm.
One hit the Persian Gulf, and the other hit a Starbucks.
Oh, jeez.
And then after that, we kept getting alerts. So we'd have to keep donning all our masks, and you're, you know, sweating, your mask is almost falling off your face.
Mm-hmm.
Or you're in the chow hall, you get your food, you sit down, alarm goes off, you have to stop eating, put your stuff on, go to a bunker. So it sucked.
Yeah.
Then we end up going to the Iraq-Kuwait border, and everybody's taking their chemical suits off because we're going into Iraq. Because we're like, oh, Iraq's not going to bomb itself. Which, you know, they have done in the past. With
the gases. Okay. Yeah, I was a little confused, but that makes sense. Sure.
So then we drove up probably 3 hours on MSR Tampa, which is military supply route, or they call it Highway 8 or the Highway of Death, because it's a north-south route from Kuwait to Baghdad. And in Desert Storm, there was a line of vehicles. I think they were either going to or coming from Kuwait to, mm-hmm. I think they were going to Kuwait to attack.
Uh-huh.
And then we just bombed the crap out of all the vehicles.
Yeah.
And what they did since then is they moved those vehicles to the side of the road, and
they
they're
just
like still there.
Yeah, they're still there.
So we drove by that, which was kind of wild. Like, wow, that was, you know, last time's worth.
They're probably still there.
Oh yeah, definitely.
Yeah.
And yeah, that was all desert, and it's not like the rolling dunes. It's just like talcum powder sandstorms mm-hmm. every day. Our mission was driving 5,000 gallons of JP-8 jet fuel.
Mm-hmm.
So we drove jet fuel all over Iraq, which was cool that we get to, you know, see the country. Did a Iraqi safari pretty much.
Yeah.
Every day we would drive to a different FOB, COB, they call them different names, different bases depending on the size.
Forward operating base.
Yeah. And that would fuel up the generators for power. That would fuel up the Humvees to go on missions. It would fuel up tanks. It would fuel up jets, like you name it, anything. And JP, it's pretty stable as a fuel.
Yeah.
Because we had some of our convoys get, like, shot at.
Mm-hmm.
And some bullets would hit the tanks. And then we'd show up and there'd be some fuel
leaking
out of the side.
Mm-hmm.
It was actually more dangerous with the fumes.
Yeah.
So we would... So if you have a 5,000-gallon tanker, you don't fill it to 5,000. We'd fill it to, like, 4,700 gallons.
Mm-hmm.
So we could slosh around and expansion of heat and everything else. And then when we would download the fuel at, like, Baghdad Airport, we would keep, like, 300 to 500 gallons in it.
Mm-hmm.
That way we could fuel ourselves up to save time.
Yeah.
We'd sleep on the trucks. And we would just grind, like, every day was a mission, anywhere from 3 hours to
so these trucks, they're, these fuel trucks, they're 18-wheelers, are they?
Yeah, so these were 18-wheelers. They were, like, the Vietnam-style
mm-hmm.
818s.
Yeah.
Stick shift, which was nice, but they were not comfortable. It was, you know, a piece of angle iron and then a cushion, like, 2 inches thick, and then you get your gear on. It's so loud in the truck, you can't really talk to each other unless you're yelling.
Yeah.
So 8 hours in a vehicle, you're just looking out the window like, all right, are we going to get shot at or blown up? Like, what? You know, mm-hmm. there's so much stuff that goes through your head.
Yeah. Yeah.
Which is wild. I remember thinking about, like, you know, when we're in a safe area in Iraq, from when we'd leave to go towards Baghdad, there'd be a stretch of, like, oh, what am I, you know, what kind of car am I going to get when I get home? Or you think about everything.
Yeah.
And then you get into a sketchy area, like we would drive through the Sunni Triangle, which was a hot area for ambushes and stuff.
Mm-hmm.
Then you start to game plan, like, okay, if there's an attack, are we going to keep pushing through? Am I going to get out and help? Are we going, you know what I mean? You start, mm-hmm. like, game planning and getting creative, because then if you don't do that and something happens, you're frozen.
Right. So, well, everyone has their own job, though, too.
Yeah.
I mean, you know, and it's important to stick to that job.
Yeah.
I imagine, in, you know, I couldn't speak to what you saw or what you went through, but you don't deviate from the plan unless you have to.
Yeah.
You know, you're not improvising. It's not like a John Wick movie or something like that.
Yeah, it's pretty cut and dry. Our SOPs were, standard operating procedures were, yes, the Iraqis could have guns. You can't shoot them, but unless they point them at you. You're like, oh, great. So let's just, you know, sit there with our...
That sounds like another job that we'll talk about.
Yeah. Yeah. But, yeah, it was interesting first deployment and then very busy. Came home, back to work, and then I volunteered for a second deployment in 2005, 2006. And that's when IEDs were a thing, explosive devices, roadside bombs. Mm-hmm. So then we had up-armored Humvees. I was a 50 cal gunner, basically a 124-pound crew-serve weapon with rounds the size of a pen with 671 grains of black powder and,
yeah,
and they, you know, anti...
They move.
Personnel, yeah.
Yeah.
So, you know, my buddy Duke Law was a driver. I go, look, you drive, I'm going to gun. And he was good with that, and I was good with being a gunner.
Could you have swapped?
Yeah, we could. A lot of people swapped, but I'm like, if we get into a gunfight, like, I want to be in this gunfight.
Okay.
Just because I want to be the person that has control over what's happening.
Yeah.
Instead of, I'm getting shot at, let me try and drive out of here.
Yeah.
And, like, we were so tight that, like, he was great at what he did. I was great at, like, I took my job seriously. I was vigilant, meaning in the trucks, you would have a turret, so you'd be standing behind the driver and passenger, and you'd be standing up in the turret, like, all day long.
Yeah.
And some people, we'd see other companies, they would be sitting in the truck, and the 50 cal would be unmanned.
Mm-hmm.
So you'd see a convoy roll by with no gunners in the convoy.
Yeah.
And then if you're the bad guy, you're going to say, I'm going to shoot these guys because they don't have guns on target. They're not scanning the area. And we never get attacked because we always had staggered guns, checking rooftops. Hey, get in the binos, check this village over here, because we would break down in certain areas and we'd be stuck in the middle of nowhere, sometimes for hours.
Break down mechanically.
Yeah, mechanically break down. And then we'd have to, or we'd find an IED and we'd have to wait for EOD to come.
Yeah.
One time I found an IED and...
I don't mean to interrupt you.
Yeah.
There's a lot of acronyms
involved, so,
and I don't know that IED, anyone will understand what you're talking about.
So, improvised explosive device. Yeah. So we were driving.
And then EOD is
explosive ordnance disposal.
Sure. Yeah.
So EOD is like the bomb techs that come in the suits and they cut the wires, the correct wires.
Don't cut the blue wire.
Yeah. So... I found, because I was so high in the truck, this one was like a 5-ton, like a cab over kind of truck. And I was higher than everybody, all the gunners could see. And there was a berm on the side of the road. And I saw what looked like something that a coffin would go in, like a rectangle hole in the ground.
Mm.
And I'm like, oh, that's peculiar.
Mm-hmm.
And then we keep driving. And then I see this cone-shaped, looks like artillery round.
Mm.
So either somebody unearthed it or tried to hide it type thing so they could use it against us.
Yeah.
So I called it up on the radio to the convoy commander who's in charge of the convoy of, you know, it could be two trucks, it could be 20, 30 trucks.
Mm-hmm.
And I told him, I'm like, hey, it's Sergeant Dage. I found a possible IED. And I'm no bomb guy. I'm like, this looks like it goes boom, so let's call it up. And then he comes back over the radio. It's going to be anywhere from 3 to 13 hours for the bomb guys to show up.
Interesting that you don't have a specialist in the convoy. That's his, you know what I mean?
Well, the thing is I feel like the misconception is when convoys leave the base, there's not many convoys. There is hundreds of convoys that leave. There's like, you know, maybe I'm just throwing a number out there. There could be 20 convoys that leave between 8 a.m. and noontime going all over Iraq. And then there's 50 other bases. So there's a lot of trucks out there.
Mm-hmm. Sorry to interrupt, but you're a driver and you're a gunner on any particular piece of equipment, correct?
Yeah.
There's two soldiers on each truck.
Three. There's a TC. So there's a passenger, too.
Okay.
And he would man the radio. Sometimes in the first deployment, we didn't even have radios. We had like three radios for the whole convoy.
Also sounds like a job that you talk about later.
And so we had, it's called the driver, the TC, which is the truck commander.
Okay.
And then the gunner.
Yeah.
And sometimes it'd be, you'd have, you call it a VIP, like just somebody extra.
I don't know how it all works. I'm not going to claim to, but it feels like it would make sense to have at least in each convoy, two trucks, 30 trucks, however many, to have at least one or two explosive
guys.
That would, that way you can keep moving,
Yeah, but I think there was
isn't always...
they were limited in their numbers because IEDs kind of popped off in 04, 05, probably.
Yeah.
And then the workup plus the equipment that they need. Like, it's not just a bomb suit. They have robots.
Yeah.
They have the...
Okay.
They have these other trucks. I think they call them, like, Tatankas. Mm-hmm. Basically a V-shaped hull vehicle.
Yeah.
And some of them had, like, a crane arm on it. So they would try to manipulate the bomb with the crane arm or make it go off or pick it up and move it.
Yeah.
So there was a lot of equipment that they needed because even if we had one bomb guy and we showed up, he might be like, I'm not getting out of the truck if it's that type thing.
See, again, I'm being naive about this. I'm picturing it more as like a Hollywood thing.
It's just like, you know, policing where you think like, oh, why doesn't, you know,
why don't they shoot him in the kneecap?
It's like, it's like a lot of moving parts and budgetary, of course. So the option was wait 3 to 13 hours, or he goes, hey, Sergeant Dave, do you want to shoot it? And I was like, yeah, I'll shoot it.
Hell yeah.
That's what I came here for. So the 50 cal is a belt-fed machine gun. And if you could see a bomb, it could see you. So I got really low in the turret because I didn't want any shrapnel to come after me. Mm-hmm. And I told my buddy Duclaw, I'm like, dude, back up a bit. So I wanted to get as far away as I could, but still have a shot.
Yeah. And is there like an iron sight?
Yeah, it's just these old, it's like, you know, so it's a, they call it a Mod Deuce, and I think it came out in 1952. Mm-hmm. I could be wrong.
Yeah.
I mean, it's like a very old, but it
still works.
Yeah. So very rudimentary optics on it.
Yeah.
And I lined up with it and I just went boom, and the whole truck moves because it's so big.
Yeah.
Then boom, boom. Then I see it spin. I'm like, boom, 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 boom. See it spin again. I'm like, oh. And then I hit it a couple times. And then we all, like idiots, we all drive up to it, like three trucks. And we're like 20 yards away.
Yeah.
And then I get in the hatch and I close it. I'm like, I'm not stupid. I'm not hanging my head out next to this bomb.
Right.
And then this active duty guy. So actually, my reserve unit got attached to this active duty field artillery unit. And field artillery are the guys that drop these ordnances in a cannon and they go so high and so far and, you know, blow stuff up.
Yeah.
So this guy was on the 60, like the Rambo gun.
Yep.
And he just went, the thing went boom. And then we're like, all right,
and
not
you're 20
a problem
yards
anymore.
Away from it. Yeah. Now. Yeah.
And I don't know if it was the full explosion or if it was the primer. I mean, it was big enough where we were like, okay, all the sand came up. And
so in, you know, you're on a road now, like, how wide is this roadway that you're on?
So actually on this part, the road was so bad with bombs, it was like Swiss cheese. So what we did was we drove probably 100 yards off the road.
Okay.
Because the desert was smoother.
Yeah.
And less chance, you know, air quotes, less chance for bombs. And then there was that berm.
Yeah.
So we were like, there was the road, then some distance where we were driving, then a little berm, then that bomb. Yeah.
And is this roadway paved?
Yeah, but the way they pave roads, I remember we broke down one time. I could pick up a piece of the pavement because I said it got 120.
Yeah, it's just so
the hottest
hot.
It got, it was 140 degrees in 2003.
And asphalt.
It's just crumbles.
Yeah, and it melts. And
yeah, it's so sticky. It's like, it's, you know, they're not doing state standards of 6 inches of...
It's not the Autobahn.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, so... Yeah. And it was a western part of Iraq in the Al Anbar province. There was a lot of activity there, busy convoys, a lot of IEDs and stuff. But yeah, I'd like to say we got lucky, but you know, we were vigilant. We had some small stuff happen that everyone came home and came home and got right into the police academy.
Yeah, so let's talk about that. So you come home, I think I think I met you after your first tour, and then you went back. In fact, I know that because you asked Robin and I to learn a song called...
Oh, yeah. Here Without You.
Yeah, Here Without You. Yeah, yeah.
Yeah, that was the after the first one. That was cool.
Yeah. So now you're back overseas. You do that, and then you come home.
Yeah.
And in the second... But in your second tour, you're the gunner. Now, I want to ask you this because I vaguely remember you telling me this.
Yeah.
That there was... In this turret, I guess you'd call it, or you know, where the gun is, was there some sort of device in there that emitted some sort of an electromagnetic field or something?
I think they call them the Warlock or something, but basically, either in the Humvee or the 5-ton or whatever gun truck you were in, it looked like the size of a microwave, and it was in this encasement, and they said don't open it. Don't look at it. Don't touch it.
Yeah.
But basically, because IEDs started off as like washing device timers. So what they would do is bad guys would see a convoy and they would like pass a bridge and they'd be like, all right, it's going to take them about a minute to get from that bridge to this rock. And they would use that rock as like a crosshair.
Yeah.
And then they would set the timer for like a minute. But then, you know, if the truck slowed down or stopped, bomb would go off. It wouldn't hit anybody. Mm-hmm. And then as time went on, they started getting smarter and they started attaching cell phones to it. So then they would use that rock as a, you know, how explosions work is if you put a firecracker in your hand and your hand's open and you let it go off, you might get a little burn.
Yeah.
But if you close your hand,
you're going to blow your hand off.
You're going to blow your fingers off.
Yeah.
So what they would do is they'd put it next to a wall or something, a hard surface. And then they'd be far enough away where they could see a truck coming. And when it would go by that structure, say rock, they would call that number. It would make the bomb go off. So then what the military started doing is coming up with this Warlock system, or it could be another name, I could be wrong, but this system where it was like they'd put this microwave sized box in the truck, it would emit an invisible bubble that would jam signals.
Okay.
So if you were driving by and they called that phone, it would jam the signal long enough till you would pass, and then it would either go off or not go off.
Yeah. I wanted to bring that up because we're going to keep talking, but I feel like that might be an important part of the rest of your story.
Oh, yeah, definitely.
Whether or not anyone wants to admit it or not is a whole other thing. But so now you get home from your service, and not to sound cliche, but thank you.
Yeah.
And I'm extremely proud to know you for being – as brave and decent a person as you are to want to defend our country.
Thank you.
And, you know, we're not going to get into politics or anything, but, you know, our country needs to be defended all over the globe.
Yeah.
But at any rate, well, that's a whole other, I'll interview someone else about that. But at any rate, so now you get home. What year is it? 2005?
So, 05 into 06. Yep. So I came home in 06. And then I was a second class in 06 in December.
Second class.
So the recruit class.
Okay. The police department.
Yeah.
Yeah. And which fine Massachusetts police department did you join?
The Worcester Police Department. Yep.
The best one.
Yeah, the best one. Yeah. We have our own academy.
Good for you. I'll drink to that.
Yeah. So the funny part was before I went to Iraq in 05, I got the letter from Worcester saying, like, you're accepted. And... you know, there is some cool stuff about the government where they had to hold my spot even though I was getting deployed.
Yeah.
But what I had to do is I had to go to JAG, the Judge Advocate General, the military lawyers, like Tom Cruise. And
just like him.
Yeah. And I said, hey,
he was a good race car driver, too. And a jet pilot. But anyway, go on.
And then I had to have my dad as a power of attorney. So my dad went to City Hall and signed all the paperwork. And then he started to go into the recruit meetings.
Really?
To sign my paperwork.
Yeah.
So everyone's like, who doesn't have a pen? And my dad's like raising his hand. Like, I don't have a pen. And there's all these kids, like scared kids going into the academy.
Right.
So he was.
And as I remember, I think your dad has signed a few detail slips. Over he's like, you know, the cops in this room should have a pen.
Yeah.
But go ahead.
Yeah, he was getting some looks from the younger guys and some of the cadre knew him. So. Yeah. they knew the deal. So then when I got home, I had that spot locked in for the academy. And what I've learned through the military is I don't believe anything until it happens.
Mm-hmm.
Because everyone's like, oh, you're going, you know, you're going to the police academy. I'm like, I'm not saying I'm going to the academy until I'm like driving there and, you know,
until you're standing in the parking lot with your bag and your,
and they make it feel like that too. Like you do a background check, you do a PT, a physical training test, you do all this stuff. And then you still like, don't know.
Yeah.
You have this long angst of like, am I going to be able to do it? Cause it's not easy. Well, now it's probably easy, but at the time it was not easy.
Well, I have to ask only because it, I remember when I went through it and in fact, today, as we're recording, is my 36th anniversary.
Oh, that's awesome.
Yeah. but I remember standing in the parking lot, freezing rain, with my little brown uniform on and my blue hat, and you couldn't bend the bill.
Yeah.
You know, I looked like a goop ball, and I was a little young. I was a kid. I was a child. You were probably older than me when you started. But I can't imagine that you found the police academy to be very challenging after having been in boot camp and overseas and all of that.
The head games I knew were a head game.
Yeah.
Like, you know, you're not fast enough. This is off. And it's like, okay, I get it. The only stress for me was literally like the studying portion
of
it.
Yeah, yeah. That
because
was,
that was like, I crushed the PT. I got top shot in the academy. Like that stuff's easy.
Yeah.
But telling me to memorize, you know, probable cause and all these con law and crim law stuff, it was a struggle. And my dad told me, he was like, you never studied in high school.
Mm.
And I was like, yeah, I never did study. Like, my senior year, I had video one, video two, where I did burnouts in my Camaro.
Yeah.
And, like, my buddy jumping off my roof onto the trampoline when my parents weren't home. Like, stupid stuff.
Sounds like we lived parallel lives.
Yeah. Yeah. And I'm like, I never did study because I'd get home from school. My parents would ask, do you have homework? And I'm like, nope.
Nope.
And then I'd go, you know, go play football or do something stupid.
Right.
So... so yeah, then I had to learn how to study, which was, you know, it was a grind for me. And one of my buddies I studied with ended up going to Secret Service shortly after graduating.
Mm.
So me and him, we would meet up at Barnes and Noble's and we'd take a few breaks, get some magazines, chill out. Like we just need to get out of the house because the Worcester Academy is 6 months long, Monday through Friday. You go home at the end of the night, but it's not like you could go out and grab a beer because it's a small enough department where if somebody hears that you were out drinking, that gets back to the staff and they're like,
you know, and there was homework. There was, I mean, people don't really understand like shining your shoes.
Yeah. And, it takes a while.
Polishing, you know, ironing your uniform and every little thread, all those things. And, you know, I don't, again, I don't know what it's like now.
Yeah.
I think it's a little bit easier, but which it shouldn't be for a lot of reasons. But that's my opinion and only mine. But I agree. Like it was, that was a harrowing experience.
Yeah.
And you really were on the straight and narrow the whole time.
Oh,
like you really,
And we were lucky because it was wintertime, which meant like, all right, there's no stress on my buddies. Let's go to the beach type thing. It was like, hey, the weather sucks. Like I'm going to stay inside. I got to make my turkey sandwich for tomorrow and write a 5,000 word essay on uniform appearance and study and all this stuff.
Yeah.
So academy was, you know, difficult, but not awful.
Yeah.
And there's a great term that people use too. Like you're the most, what is it? You're the most up to date legally. With zero experience.
Yep.
Like, you could give somebody a written test who's been there 30 years. I mean, there's some guys in the DB who, like, know their stuff inside and out. But you are the most trained with zero experience. And it's wild to put on that uniform graduation day. And I remember going to grab a coffee, and I'm like, holy crap, like, I'm a cop now? Like, people ask me something, and I have to answer it.
Yeah. It's scary, right?
Yeah.
It's a little frightening.
Yeah.
And again, like, I mean, thinking about what you did in the military and what you went through with that. But I guess every experience isn't like every like significant experience in your life is a new one.
Yeah.
And even that, like you, and I don't know about you, like I did not feel confident about going out into the world and being a policeman and that.
It feels so weird because there's so much unknown of like, what if this guy does this? And what, I mean, I hate the what ifs in like training scenarios.
Yeah.
But when you put on your uniform and you're a cop, you're the same cop that's been there for 2 years or
right.
30 years.
Yeah.
Like, you have to give the same effort.
Yeah.
Or, you know, you have to give the right answer.
Well, I'll tell you a story when we're done about a colleague of ours that on his very first day had a day that would make most people give up the job.
Oh, yeah.
And he lasted 37 years.
Yeah.
So that's the thing about being a police officer is you could go through your entire career.
Yeah.
From start to finish and never see anything crazy. That's doubtful. But
yeah.
But, I mean, on your very first day, and again, I won't share the story here, but when he told me, and he sort of shared this with me privately, I started to cry.
Yeah.
You know, I was like, how are you here 37 years later? It's crazy. So, I don't think a lot of people understand that.
Yeah.
That,
let's like picture your worst day as a cop, and then picture that being somebody's first day.
Yeah.
It's insane.
Yeah.
To comprehend, like,
yeah.
How to deal with it, how to digest it, how to,
right.
What do I do?
Right. And when you graduate from the academy and they say, okay, you're going to be trained by Tom Hurley or
yeah.
John Dage or whoever, and they... You know, and then you meet that guy. You don't know this guy.
Yeah.
You don't know him at all. And then you get in a car, and the first thing the veteran guy does is like, all right, kid.
Yeah.
You know, let's go to
Kelly Square.
Take that off. Get rid of that stupid thing you're wearing. This is nonsense, and let's go get a coffee.
Yeah. I remember
and you're like, I want to go answer. No, we're not answering calls until they call up. You know what I mean? Like, it's all...
My first call, I was like, of course, this is my first call. I was with Kevin Fleming,
mm-hmm.
and it was a Sunday, so I think it, you know, might have been a rough morning for some. And it was
Kevin,
day shift. And my first call was destruction of property. It was like broken flower vases at a shop. I was like, this is my first call being a city cop. It's like broken flowers.
Mm-hmm.
I'm like, this is awesome. Liz, can't wait to get into this.
Yeah.
But it's
funny.
Yeah,
but then it all changes. So, all right. So now you're a cop.
Yeah.
And what happens next? Like, what do you, I know what goes on, but tell people what goes on with you.
So, so I trained on days, and I think my fourth day working, I had 3 days of a field training officer, and they're the guys who like, this is what you're supposed to do. Here's what, you know, do this, don't do that. And the fourth day, they were short in Maine South, and they put me on like Route 12, which was
short,
downtown.
Short
staffed,
Not enough people came to work that day.
Yeah. So then they're like, oh, yeah, JD could ride by himself
on day four.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah.
But Worcester's great. The city's way different than other towns. Like, if there's a call for a hit, somebody hits your car, somebody breaks in your house, like, it only takes one cop to go take a report.
Right.
But if there's a call that comes out for a guy with a machete or a guy with a gun, everybody's going to that call.
Yeah.
Even if it's a domestic or something, like, everybody's going.
Yeah.
So you're not really getting thrown to the wolves. I mean,
right.
Yeah, a little bit, but.
Yeah. And despite the fact that you're on your own, quote unquote.
Yeah.
There's a lot of senior guys that know you're brand new, and you know, that was my thing. I trained a lot of people. I trained the current chief, although I mean he had experience prior to that, but I, you know, there was a lot of, I could name names, of all the solid guys that I'm very proud of that. But they all started out with me saying, "Stay in the car, kid.
Yeah,
don't move. I'll be right back."
Yeah,
and they're like, "Well, I'm a cop." No, you're not.
Yeah.
Not yet.
Yeah.
You know, you might be trained and everything, but stay in the car.
Yeah, and my FTO got federally indicted.
Oh, my goodness. we'll talk about
that. Yeah, let's skip
later
that one.
Yeah. So you're now, all right, so you're moving along, and you're working in operations division. And
yeah, operations for a little bit. Then all the new guys, my whole class got stuck in the cell room, so we had to drive the paddy wagon, do fingerprints, do the prisoner stuff.
Yeah.
And because I was not at the top of that academic list,
yeah,
it took me and a couple other guys 3.5 years to actually get out and do cop stuff.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, it got old, but that's why I like to drive the paddy wagon, because then I could get out, drive around instead of be stuck in the station. And got into operations, which is answering calls for service.
911 calls.
Yeah. And I was in, I liked being in the busy areas because it made time go by. And then I got put with my buddy, Sean Martha, who we would just go, I would drive, he would type. By the time I'd put it in drive, he'd already have a report written. And we would be like, all right, let's go to the next one, or let's go pull over cars, or let's go look for warrants or whatever.
Yeah.
And in 2012, I ended up having pain in my groin, which I thought was a hernia.
Mm-hmm.
Because back to 2003 when I was in Iraq, I was in a tent with like 20 dudes sleeping. And I woke up at 2 in the morning. I'm like, oh, it's weird. I don't have to go to the bathroom. Like, why am I up? And then all of a sudden I had this extreme pain. So basically my intestinal wall broke and I had an inguinal hernia.
Okay.
So the hernia happened. The pain went away, and then I went back to bed. I'm like, I'm not telling anybody. I'm not having surgery here. Like, I didn't know what it was. Yeah. So when I came home in 05, I had surgery. Then I got deployed again. So in 2012, I was like, oh, I got pain. I've been working out a lot. It's probably another hernia.
Mm-hmm.
So I go to the ER, and they do the ultrasound on my testicle, which was, you know, extremely comfortable when you're in a room full of nursing students.
Yeah.
And they're, you know, so I didn't, you know, there was a lot of things it could have been, you know, like, especially the Googling, like, what could this be?
Mm-hmm.
And I sat down in the urologist's office. He came in and said, well, Mr. Dage, it looks like you have a growth. And the only thing I could think of, wait, by growth, do you mean tumor?
Mm.
He said, yes, most likely it's testicular cancer. Most common between the ages of 16 and 30 years old.
Wow.
And I was 29 at the time. I was like, almost made it.
Yeah, right.
So the option was, well, the only option was to have surgery. So remove the testicle, outpatient surgery, and then go home and heal up.
Mm-hmm.
So I had that done a week later, healed up. Another month or so went by. I had to have scans. So what I've learned is it's probably close to 200 different types of cancer.
Mm-hmm.
And with the testicular cancer, the blood draw they had was it was called the alpha fetoproteins. So anybody could have a blood draw, and alpha fetoproteins would say, you know, 11, 12, 15 or whatever, and that would be a normal range. My alpha fetoproteins were like 55,000.
Oh, my goodness.
Which meant like there was a tumor.
Yeah.
So then my numbers were elevated. We did a scan, whether it was a CT scan or an MRI, and they found swollen lymph nodes. And the lymph nodes were so swollen that I could have either left it the way it was, or I could have opted for a very invasive surgery to have it removed.
Mm-hmm.
Because that growth could have turned into a teratoma, which is gross. It's hair, teeth, nails, bone. It's just like a growth of like mass in your body.
Wow.
It's insane. And it's disgusting to...
No, when, but I've never heard of this. So you're
basically
saying
it's like
even as a man, you're sort of growing the parts of another person.
Yeah. And I didn't want that to happen.
Yeah.
So I was like, yes, I want that surgery. So they had a lymph node dissection surgery. They cut me open from the top of my waist all the way to the bottom of my sternum. They take all your insides, put them on your chest.
Mm-hmm.
So you're like a human canoe. Then they take the lymph nodes out that are like towards your kidneys, which I don't get. You don't go from the back, but, you know, whatever. I'm no surgeon.
Sure.
And then they put everything back in, which leaves you super distended. And like they sew you back up. So I have a huge scar. It's pretty clean. They didn't do like the staples. So mm-hmm. it looks like I have a 2-pack at least. And that was a 6-month slow, painful recovery.
Yeah.
So from there, healed up, went back to work. And then at the time, Worcester, we have our own SWAT team. And every 3 years or so, there's SWAT tryouts.
Mm-hmm.
And it's like a 2-day tryout of like running, shooting, jumping, test taking, and then running and running. You know, they just...
Mm, yeah.
I wouldn't say haze, but it's a 2-day nonstop.
No, they want to make sure you can do the job
yeah.
in the real world.
Work under pressure.
Yeah.
So I was training for that. I remember I was pushing a sled that I welded up with weights on it. Mm-hmm. And me and some guys were at WPI college working out. And then I coughed up blood. And then I'm like, oh, that's weird. And like a typical guy, I waited 5 days of coughing up blood before I went to the doctors. Mm-hmm. So I went to the doctors again. They did scans on my chest. And they said, your testicular cancer, which was called mixed germ cell non-seminoma tumors, mm-hmm. spread to 6 tumors in my chest and lungs. So then at that local hospital, they said, you need to go to Boston because Boston has Dana-Farber Cancer Institute, which is world-renowned. Mm-hmm. So I went there for a second opinion. I met Dr. Sweeney, my oncologist for testicular cancer, and he said, you're not leaving. This is stage 4. Because it was pushing on my jugular, on my lungs, like pushing against my stomach. And I had some red flags of, yeah, coughing up blood, but also like losing weight. Mm-hmm. I mean, I was working out to get on the SWAT team, but I know what it takes me to lose weight. I need to do a lot of cardio. I need to eat less.
Yeah.
But I was doing more of like a running, climbing ropes, lifting some weights, not enough for me to be dropping weight. Mm-hmm. So, you know, that was a red flag I didn't really pay attention to. Then I couldn't go home, and they ended up hooking me up with chemo. So I had 3 different chemotherapies that were very invasive. I think I had 8 bags total with the chemo. And I was hooked up 8 hours a day, 5 days a week. So I had 2 IVs in my arms, and I couldn't leave the hospital room for 5 days. Then I would go home for 2 weeks, and I would feel like crap, kind of like a hangover. Like chemo leaves you bad taste in your mouth, chemo brain, where you keep repeating yourself to, you know, I'd be laying in bed like, I need to change all my energy efficient light bulbs in this house. And then I'd go spend $200 at Lowe's because I need to get light bulbs. Like stupid. I like to say everybody's cancer story is unique because I don't want to scare people of like, chemo's awful. And, you know, my chemo, it was very invasive. And that's what led me to have like the bad taste in my mouth constantly and all that stuff. I couldn't eat hot, spicy food, which I like spicy food. Mm-hmm. I couldn't watch any like Hallmark commercials because I'd bawl my eyes out. Mm-hmm. Well, like just very, you know.
I do that.
Yeah. So it was that type of stuff where I realized like, okay, this is the chemo. And then the chemo wears off. Then you get it again. So I had that for 5 months. Mm. Then the tumor shrunk. So I needed the tumor residue removed. So then they had to go from the back. They cut through my lat muscle. They had to break a rib. And when they work on your lung, they deflate it. And your right lung is made up of 3 lobes, top, middle, and bottom. Left lung has 2 because your heart takes up a good portion of the cavity. Mm-hmm. So they removed the top and bottom portion of my right lung. So I had 1/3 of my right lung removed. That was a painful recovery because of all the muscle and tissue and all that. I went back 2 weeks later for a follow-up to see how the surgery was. They were like, yeah, your surgery looks great, but tumor spread to the brain.
Oh, my goodness.
So now that same testicular cancer spread from the testicles to the chest and lungs to the brain. So I needed brain surgery, which was the easiest surgery because there's nothing up there, but there's no muscle up there.
Yeah.
So like it's skin and bone and the tumor was resting on the brain. Mm-hmm. So I think I had surgery Friday and I was home Sunday watching the Patriots game.
Wow.
And they did, I'd say they Dremeled a hole, cut the skin. So I have like a scar. I'd say they Dremeled a hole, popped the skull, took the tumor out, put everything back in. And then I had radiation like 5 or 6 times. Mm-hmm. Basically, they bolted my head to a table, and then they do a local radiation. Then I had 10% of my left lung removed from tumor residue, which was a scope surgery, so there's 3 holes on the back. So it was a very less invasive than the first one. Then they opted to have chemo again, outpatient surgery, so I get to go home at the end of the day, which was better.
What's the time frame over this particular episode that you're describing?
So testicular cancer started in 2012, and then after the chemo, and then a second brain surgery because he came back in the brain again after the chemo, because chemo doesn't break the blood-brain barrier. Brain surgery and chemo, radiation a second time. So between 2012 and 2015, I had 10 procedures. And then I went right back to work to being a cop after I healed up. So I didn't realize how much trauma my body went through. Like, I just kept wanting to, oh yeah, I could run 2 miles. And in the meantime, I started cycling. My buddy got me into riding.
Yeah.
So I bought a road bike with the skinny tires and the spandex suit. And we started riding, and we raised money for Dana-Farber Cancer Institute. So the first year, I think we raised $26,000 with 4 riders.
Wow.
Which was pretty cool.
Yeah, I should explain to anyone that's listening that you're still very fit, always been fit. I mean, I wonder how much of that really kept
it
you.
Helps. Yeah.
Yeah, it helped a lot, I imagine. But at any rate, I'm sorry to interrupt.
Yeah.
So you're now cycling.
Yeah, so I started cycling, which I fell in love with. I'm like, get on the bike and ride 20 miles, 30 miles through Central Mass, there's hills.
You decide to start cycling after you've had two-thirds of
third
a
lung. Right lung, 10% of the left lung, yeah.
Okay, yeah.
Because I didn't know if I was going to get back to work and run and shoot and jump and all that stuff. Mm-hmm. And I'm like, I run because I know I have to run. Like, typically I would do mile and a half run, or I would run. I used to live on Lake Ave by the park, so I would run a mile. Then I would sprint every other telephone pole back.
Mm.
Because as a cop, like, you need to sprint sometimes.
Mm-hmm.
And I always enjoyed that, because with football, there was always sprints. Like, I could never do, like, yeah, let me just go out and run 5-10 miles. Like, that's that wasn't my thing.
Yeah.
That wasn't my jam. Like, yeah. I would make myself run a mile and a half or 2 miles just to do it.
Yeah.
So, and because I could do it. So now, Dana-Farber actually took my story for the Pan Mass. So the Pan Mass is a just under 200-mile bike ride in 2 days in August every year.
Mm-hmm.
And all the money we raise goes to cancer research and all that stuff at Dana-Farber. So they took my story, had the new WBZ, I think it was, came, and they recorded me and some of the team, and they used that as part of the opening ceremony. And that weekend in August was actually my 1 year cancer-free.
Hmm.
So, like, beating cancer, getting into cycling over 1,000 miles that summer, and then riding for a cancer ride, and then sitting there on live Boston TV with my story and like 4 other people's stories. I was like, this is fucking awesome.
Yeah.
And it was an amazing feeling to do that. And after that, I said, it's great that we're raising money for the Cancer Institute. But during that time, my friends had a benefit for me to raise money because I was out of work.
Yeah.
And I say, money's not the cure, but it helps.
Mm-hmm.
And it relieves stress.
Yeah.
And a lot of undue stress. So what we did in that was 2015. 2016, we turned our team name, Thin Blue Ride, into a official 501c3. So we raise money for first responders, veterans, their family. And now we raise money for children with cancer as well.
Mm-hmm.
So since 2016, when we started, we're probably up over $900,000 that we've raised. And we don't take a percentage. We give everything we raise to the families.
Yeah.
I say we have the worst business model ever. So if we raise $1,000 for somebody, we'll give them $1,200 or $1,500. Or if we raise, so we sell t-shirts and we have a golf tournament and we have events. Yeah. So we take from our capital to add, to give, like, hey, share this with your family and friends, like a GoFundMe.
Mm-hmm.
We're not taking a percentage. And because we're a nonprofit, there's no fees attached to that.
Yeah.
And we choose not to do that. We choose not to pay ourselves. And
yeah.
I think that's what makes us different than a lot of nonprofits.
Yeah. When we began talking at the very beginning here, I held up this, which is your book.
Oh, yeah.
And I had it upside down.
Yeah.
Because you're standing on your head on the cover, and it's called Beyond Survival, What Comes After the Fight, Choosing to Thrive, by Sergeant Jonathan Dage. You want to talk about this book that you wrote? You've been listening to part 1 of a 2-part interview with John Dage.
Join us next time for the conclusion. You won't want to miss it here on Beautiful Minds, an exploration into the minds of creative people and what makes them tick. This program is a production of Audio Journal, a proud member of the Massachusetts Audio Information Network. Please remember, we would love to hear from you. Are there any local musicians or artists that you'd like to hear from? Call or email us with any suggestions or general feedback. Call us at 508-797-1117 or email us at info@audiojournal.org. And before I leave, as always, I'd just like to say I'm grateful for the universe and for whatever put us all here. And I'm grateful for all the gifts that it's given me. And I'm grateful for you for being with me here today. Have a great day and thanks for listening. And join us next time for part two of J.D. John Dage.
You are listening to Audio Journal, a proud member of the Massachusetts Audio Information Network.
Are you a senior who is dealing with vision loss? Would you like to learn about advocacy efforts on behalf of seniors who are blind? And about support calls, where you can talk with other seniors who are also dealing with vision loss? If so, join us, the Alliance on Aging and Vision Loss, an affiliate of the American Council of the Blind. To learn more, visit our website, www.aavl-blind-seniors.org.
This is Bird Note. The cheerful-voiced chestnut-collared longspur gets along well with the cattle that share its northern prairie breeding range, for the most part. But that relationship is not always an amicable one. Cows will sometimes step on the longspur's neatly woven nests in the grass, and there are records of grazing cattle nudging eggs and chicks out of the nests and eating them. In a few cases, heavy grazing appears to have caused adult longspurs to abandon their efforts to breed for the season. However, if cows are managed properly, they may be able to help longspurs persist. 200 years ago, the birds shared the prairie with bison, which kept the grasses short enough for the birds to nest. Today, on the northern Great Plains, longspur breeding success rates have been shown to increase when ranchers carefully manage their cattle to avoid overgrazing and habitat degradation. And grassland birds need every bit of help they can get, even from cows. For Bird Note, I'm Mary McCann.
Welcome to Everyday Poems for Everyday, sponsored by Audio Journal. Our poem today is All That Is Gold Does Not Glitter by J.R.R. Tolkien. All that is gold does not glitter. Not all those who wander are lost. The old that is strong does not wither. Deep roots are not reached by the frost. From the ashes a fire shall be woken, a light from the shadows shall spring. Renewed shall be the blade that was broken, the crownless again shall be king. You've been listening to Everyday Poems for Everyday, sponsored by Audio Journal, and read by me, Nikki Whichello. Thanks for listening. May your life be filled with poetic wonder.